We're going to open the floor now to questions. And if you want to stand up and ask a question, I'll walk around with the mic. And I know lots of people probably have questions, so we'll start with this young fellow.
Thank you very much. This kind of relates somewhat to Dr. Plantinga's question about how do we know the whole universe didn't just pop into existence 5 minutes ago. I've been thinking a lot recently about how do we even know there is an inanimate external world. If you consider our experienced objects, sight objects, sound objects, smell objects, they're all contingent on being experienced by us. Once we stop experiencing them, they don't exist. So how do we even know there's an inanimate external world? And connected to that, it seems to me the universe, if it exists, it's either infinite or it's finite. I have a hard time with either one of those. So maybe the conclusion is it doesn't exist.
And I definitely overpaid for the rug.
There's absolute positive surety without any doubt, and any philosopher can tell you that the list of propositions for which you're going to have that kind of certainty is very small. And then there's a kind of certainty you need to live a good life and make sensible decisions. And believing there is an external world, I think, definitely falls in the second category. Infinite, or it turns out that there's in terms of the universe being infinite or finite, I think what the average scientist would say today is, well, actually, we've got mathematical models that can work both ways, and we're going to let the data tell us ultimately what it is. Is there more to say about that?
Well, on the first point, how do we know that? Why do we think that there is an external world? If you look, in a way, that's a really good question. You know, how do we know there's been a past? How do we know there's an external world? How do we know there are other people? If you try to give arguments for any of those things, you wind up not being successful at all. One of the main lessons of modern philosophy from Descartes through Hume is that there aren't any good arguments for there being other people or for there being an external world. There just aren't any good arguments. But the fact is, it's not that any of us believe these things on the basis of arguments. That's not how I come to think that there are other people. It's not that I think to myself, well, I look at this body, and it's carrying on in the same way that I carry on, that my body carries on when I have a toothache, so probably there's a self connected with that body that has a toothache. That's not how anybody thinks. We are so created, I would say this is really the philosopher Thomas Reed's story. God has so created us that there are lots of starting points for thought, including that there is an external world, including that there are other people, including that there's been a past. It isn't that you need an argument for those things. It isn't that you, in fact, believe those things on the basis of arguments. In fact, you just start from those things, and they are just as good starting points as would be the premises of any argument you might try to produce for those things. They're not exactly, they're innate tendencies to form such beliefs under various circumstances. And the natural thing to think from a Christian perspective, it seems to me, is this: if God has in fact created us in his image, an important part of that image will be that we, like God himself, can know much about our world. So he's created us with a means to know these things, including those starting points for thought. That's the way I would think about it.
There's a way to relate this to your question, Alan. Somebody asks us, if God popped the universe into existence 5 minutes ago, fully mature, then doesn't this mean that God is intentionally deceiving us about the age of the universe, whether by scripture or by science?
I think, myself, that's the right question to ask, right? I mean, if God really did create us in his image and he really does want us to know something about what our world is like, then you wouldn't think that at the most basic levels we would get things wrong. I mean, about whether there's a world at all, about whether there's been a past, whether there are other people. I mean, when it comes to the very far reaches of science that people like Lauren work at, there things go back and forth for a while. You know, the idea is the world has been there for an infinite stretch of time. It's always been there. Then later on, no, it's kind of a steady state theory. Then later on, no, that's not right. It goes back the other way. It kind of goes back and forth when it comes to these high-level problems. There, you don't expect that our ways of knowing would be as reliable, just as if you look at a mountain goat from a long ways away in the mountains. Let's say you're 600 yards away, you see that dot. You think it's a mountain goat, and you might be right, but it might also just be a patch of snow. Of course, if you're only 10 feet from the beast, then you know it's a mountain goat. It's the same way here. When it comes to these sort of basic starting points for our thought, it would be astonishing if God so arranged it that we got all those things wrong.
And this is a good springboard to talk about the hypothetical young Earth argument, and not so hypothetical that you mentioned. If we're willing to say that the idea of God creating the Earth world 5 minutes ago with all these memories just doesn't fit well with our picture of God, and we have lots of good reasons, as Al mentioned, to reject that as Christians. Now let's go back to the idea of, well, maybe God created the world 10,000 years ago and with just sort of this mature history built in. Well, I could imagine God creating a solar system with an asteroid belt 10,000 years ago. I have trouble imagining God creating these families of asteroids where if you backpropagate their orbits, you find them all converging on the same point 160 million years ago with orbits that would exactly fit as if there was a collision 160 million years ago, including chemical residues on the Earth which coincide with that time. And that's just one example. I listed, you know, literally well over a dozen similar examples of not just appearance of age, but appearance of a very rich, detailed history, like volumes and volumes of history books. And I just find it unlikely that God would create all of that appearance of a rich, detailed history, but then make the world 10,000 years ago just so Genesis 1 could be in some sense literal historical, to which I would add one more thing. I think if you want to say that Genesis 1 should be written as literal history, you've got to explain where the firmament is, because it's there in Genesis 1 and many other passages of the Old Testament as well.
All right, any...
One more point along the same line. I think the interesting thing there to note is that what we've really got here, I think Lauren is right about that. That's the way I would also think about young Earth creationism, which therefore means it's right. But one more thing to note about that, this is really a theological objection to their view. It's not really from science exactly. It's more like, well, I can't imagine God doing something like that. God wouldn't do that. If he did, he would be deceiving us in ways that we think is incompatible with how we expect him to treat us.
Back to our live studio audience.
Lauren, as you were describing the immense and vastness of the universe, it just came to mind when I think of Jesus going to heaven and of Elisha going to heaven. Where do you see that? I can't, you know, I'm just trying to imagine where Jesus is in that vastness.
Well, I'm sure the writers of the Old Testament and the New Testament pictured at heaven as being a place above the waters, above the firmament. Now, today, I grew up in the 20th century reading science fiction. So when I picture heaven, I picture sort of parallel universes in the science fiction sort of sense of it. And that works for me. I don't know if that's any more accurate than the picture of heaven being a place above the waters, above the solid dome firmament. I think it's a pretty helpful analogy for me of picturing what's going on. It's one of these questions where we're not told a lot, I think, because we don't need to be told a lot. We're told a lot more about God's relationship to us as God's... God's power and omnipotence, but also God's presence, God's imminence. So then the question of where is heaven? I don't think of it as just if you go far enough in that direction, you'll get there. I think, you know, more in terms of the parallel universes. We'll see if that's right.
What works for you, Al?
Well, I don't think heaven, I don't think heaven is spatially, spatial-temporally connected with us. I guess I would think something like what Lauren just mentioned. Some people nowadays talk about the multiverse, in which they say there are all these different universes. There's our universe, but that's just a merest beginning. I mean, there is uncountably many others, maybe literally uncountably many, that is, more than there are natural numbers, other universes. And I don't know. I mean, that's a possibility. I think quite often it's motivated by an attempt to blunt what Lauren was speaking of as the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God, or the fine-tuning indication or pointing to the existence of God. It looks like our universe is fine-tuned in the sense that lots of things like the law of gravity, the rate of expansion of the universe have to be incredibly fine-tuned. They have to be within very, very narrow limits for there to be such a thing as life at all. And that, you might say, that's much more likely given the existence of God than given chance or given atheism. And if it is much more likely on the existence of God, then that's some kind of at least modest evidence for the existence of God. Now, some people who don't like this idea at all, and who don't like God or don't like the idea of God at all, they say, well, there are all these, you know, maybe there are all these other billions and trillions, maybe infinitely many other universes with all the various physical constants taking on different values in these various universes. And so you'd expect that one of them would be, at least one would be fine-tuned. And, of course, that's the one where we find ourselves. We couldn't find ourselves in any of the other ones. So there is this idea. And maybe we Christians can make use of it and think that, well, there's at least one extra one, possibly two if you want to count, you know, the other place. At least one other universe, heaven.
I guess you almost just answered it, but I'm thinking of the C.S. Lewis trilogy with the parallel universe where the creation and the fall and all of that goes on again. What does science think about that? Is it science fiction?
Well, you can go two ways with that question. One is other planets. And we are right now, within the last 15 years, discovering more and more and more planets out there. We can't say we've discovered one like Earth. We certainly haven't discovered one with life. But it may happen. What would that be theologically? I have read theologians who say there really shouldn't be life on any other planet than Earth because the incarnation has to be a unique event for the universe. And I've read other theologians who say quite the opposite. You know, given God and who God is, there ought to be lots of planets with lots of life forms. And interestingly enough, C.S. Lewis wrote the Space Trilogy implying, well, in that series of science fiction books, the incarnation was one event, one planet only. And then he also wrote the Narnia series where the Christ figure appears in every planet. So sort of C.S. Lewis tried to write it both ways. And so you can say that about planets in this universe. You can also imagine a similar story in parallel universes.
Somebody wrote, one of the three most brilliant men in the past several hundred years, Kelly Clark, no wait, Stephen Hawking said this, God is a fairy tale. God is not necessary for the universe, for the form and function of the universe. How would you answer him?
I've read a lot of people who are brilliant scientists and really bad philosophers and really bad theologians. Have you read a few like that, Camille?
No, never. But.
And I've also read some scientists who are really good scientists and who are much more modest in their theological and philosophical claims. I think it's pretty clear Stephen Hawking makes some fairly easily identifiable faulty assumptions in his line of reasoning, and he doesn't even present much of his line of reasoning. Most of the scientists I've talked to would say, yeah, Stephen Hawking is... I'll even go further. Most of the non-Christian scientists I've talked to would say, yeah, Stephen Hawking is drawing way too much. He's letting his religious beliefs leak into his science. He's trying to use his status as a scientist to promote religious beliefs which don't necessarily follow. Most of the non-Christian scientists I know have said or would say, I can't tell from my science which religion is right, whether God exists or not.
I think also Stephen Hawking, when he says God isn't necessary, I guess he's trying to say something like, well, we don't need God to explain the existence of the universe, and we don't need God to explain the way it works. There is this initial vacuum, and there were fluctuations, and then the universe just popped out. Maybe all that's a lot of poppycock. I don't know one way or the other. But in any event, he's got this other sort of premise lurking in the neighborhood. If we don't need God to explain things, then there must not be any such person as God. But that's crazy. I mean, Christians don't, for the most part, believe in God because they need an explanation. They don't look around when they're young and look at the world and they say, well, what would explain all this? Well, maybe the best hypothesis is Christianity. You know, there's three persons of the Trinity and so on and so on. Not at all. That's not the way it goes. That's not how people come to believe in God, just as people don't come to believe in other minds or other persons on the basis of arguments. So for the most part, they also don't come to believe in God on the basis of arguments. And it's not like if you showed that there aren't any good arguments, and of course Hawking is only talking about one argument, and he's maybe probably wrong about that one, but even if there weren't any good arguments, that wouldn't necessarily damage belief in God or make it silly or irrational or something like that at all, any more than if there aren't any good arguments for there having been a past, it's silly or irrational or something or other like that to believe that there is a past.
Yeah.
I guess these discussions for me just lead to a lot of our stewardship responsibilities for creation. And when I used to speak to small groups, I would hear things like, well, it's going to burn anyway, and there's going to be a new one anyway. And then I read things about the purging fire that, you know, the good that we do will last. It's worth doing. And what will be purged is what isn't. And that when the second coming comes, heaven is coming down to earth, and more people are writing that way. And that this is where it's going to be. I'm just wondering about your reaction to that.
That isn't my field. I would talk to some of the Christian biologists. I'm definitely, you know, thinking along the same lines as you. I've read a lot of good Christian biologists and a lot of good Christian theologians who are writing along the same lines you said. And I certainly prefer that way of thinking about it. But since it's not my area of expertise, I'm not going to say too much more about that.
You want to say something about something you don't know anything at all about, too?
I've already done enough of that.
All right.
I mean, it sounded, I really didn't quite get the gist of the question, but it sounded like something like this. If the whole earth is going to burn one way or another, either the way it's presented in the Bible or maybe a heat death or something like that. So if so, what point is there in doing the sorts of things we think we ought to be doing? And I don't know. I mean, in a way, I can sort of feel the point of the question, but in a way not, too, because we all know that we're going to die. We know there'll be a time, or at least we strongly suspect there'll be a time when hardly anybody remembers us and so on. That doesn't mean that there's no point to doing what we do. The Lord instructs us to live in a certain way, to teach each other, to treat each other in a certain way. We believe that other human beings are of inestimable value, even if they will be forgotten, at least on earth. The fact that at some time our human history will come to an end doesn't seem to me to be at all a good reason for just quietism and just sitting around watching television all the time, which is pretty dull anyway.
We're going to make this our last question, and probably it's going to win the award for cutest question. How did astronomers get to know that that little square had hundreds or thousands of galaxies?
All right. I can't pull up the picture anymore. So what they've repeated this. They picked one little spot in the sky. They didn't think that one was unusual. They thought it was just a perfectly ordinary one. They picked one that just didn't happen to have a bright star right in the middle of it. And they picked one and said, we'll just take pictures. We'll accumulate data for more than a week. And when they did, and when they downloaded the data to the computer and looked at the picture that was formed, you can, if I had the image up there and the room was dark, you could start counting, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and see how many hundreds of galaxies there are in that picture. Now, then they can go and look at another similar part of the sky, and another similar part of the sky, and another similar part of the sky, and they all look equally interesting. So what you can then do is say, okay, you count up all the galaxies we see in that picture, and then you take what fraction is that little box of the whole sky, and then how many galaxies is that total? And that's the math that's done to get up, to get to the total, the kind of math that's done to get the total number of galaxies in our visible universe.
Thank you for coming tonight, and thank our speakers.